Our guest speaker this morning has another appointment, so we want to get started and have her come up and speak early. So I'm not going to give a long introduction, but I'm very proud to have our congressional representative, Tammy Baldwin, with us this morning. Tammy's a native Madisonian. She graduated from West High School, was valedictorian of her class. When she was only 24 years old, she was a county supervisor, and by the age of 30, was serving in the state assembly as a representative for the state of Wisconsin. She has been elected to the United States House of Representatives, and she's the first woman in Wisconsin history to be in Congress. In addition to which, she's the first Madison resident to be in Congress since something like 1919, I think it is. So we're extremely proud of her. And one of the things we want to do, I hope that Representative Baldwin will be a role model for all of the young women in our congregation to show that maybe some of you will go to Congress one of these days. All righty. And I'm really happy that Representative Baldwin was willing to pose for pictures, because I think that's something that you can look back on years from now and say you had a chance to meet your congressional representative, and maybe it'll make all of you go to the polls when you get older and vote. And hopefully one of these days she's going to run for president. And by that time, I give you Tammy Baldwin.
Thank you so much. And I guess I want to add a note of encouragement that one of the things we discovered in the election process last year is that while you have to be a certain age to vote, you don't have to be a certain age to volunteer in a campaign. And we actually had huge responsibilities taken on by middle school and high school students.
Tell the funny school children that they can go downstairs.
Yeah. You're excused. But that was an important message for them to hear before they left. Oh, goodness. Well, I wanted to first make reference to the piece of paper that I found on my seat as I sat down. I did not put it there, but I started reading about the resolutions that you have passed starting back in 1962 at the first General Assembly, and it could have been written today. I just, the first few paragraphs about the attacks that the UN and the mission of the UN are under right now in politics. And I figure somebody put it on the table because it is, or on the chairs because it is so timely in that way. I wanted to cover a variety of topics, but to start by telling you that, you know, this experience so far in the U.S. Congress has been extraordinary for me. I've been absolutely delighted and often filled with awe about the responsibility you've given me. And as you can imagine, there were some topics that I came to Congress knowing a fair amount about, because I had had a chance in my public service prior to that time working on those issues. But foreign affairs, international relations, and the United Nations were in part new to me. I had studied perhaps as any citizen might, but not to the extent that we get a little bit more involved with it at the congressional level. As most of the people in this room probably know, the key focus of my campaign for Congress was the issue of health care and health care reform here in the United States. And when we hear things like the announcement earlier this month from the U.S. Census Bureau that 44 million Americans lack health insurance, we obviously understand that there's some compelling things to do, but we cannot ignore the fact that beyond the boundaries of this country, there are incredible challenges in meeting the health care needs of the people of the world. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about that this morning. I also want to then touch a little bit about the on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which we just recognized the 50th anniversary of very recently, I think it was last year. And finally, I want to say a few remarks about the situation with the United Nations dues and the debt that our country is building up in that regard before opening up for questions. And I know it has been said frequently of late, great nations pay their debts, and I think we are hoping that we will rise to the occasion and deserving of the label great nations. But let me start by talking a little bit about the health challenges facing our world. And it probably won't surprise anybody that the biggest threat to world health as we speak right now is the HIV and AIDS pandemic. And since the epidemic started in the late 1970s, it has obviously spread rapidly throughout the world. When you look at the statistics, it can be very, very depressing. According to the UNAIDS World Health Organization report in December of last year, about 33.4 million adults and children living with HIV and AIDS in the world. Of that, about 5.8 million cases are considered newly infected. And the disease is spreading most rapidly and is most devastating in the continent of Africa, where there are about 22.5 million people infected with HIV or AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa today. A child born in a high HIV prevalence country can expect right now to live 43 years. That is, a child without AIDS or born in a country where there is not a high prevalence can now in this world expect to live 60 years. And since I started addressing you about 3 or 4 minutes ago, 16 new people in this world have contracted the HIV virus. HIV/AIDS has a devastating impact on the economies of sub-Saharan Africa. Due to high infection rates, it has been estimated that by the year 2005, AIDS costs will represent more than half of Kenya's government's health spending and two-thirds of the health spending in Zimbabwe. As the Vice President of the World Bank in the Africa region said, HIV is now the single greatest threat to the future economic development of Africa. AIDS kills more adults in the prime of their working and parenting lives, decimates the workforce, fractures and impoverishes families, orphans millions, and shreds the fabrics of communities. The HIV/AIDS problem is worse in Africa, but it is intensifying in Asia as well. And India now has 10 million infected people, with the number doubling every 2 or 3 years. And other countries in Asia are in danger of comparable infection rates to the continent of Africa. While these statistics are incredibly horrifying, I guess I don't want to leave you without a sense of hope on this issue. The international health community is beginning to respond to this pandemic, and efforts are underway to reduce the spread of the disease. Since 1997, and note this is pretty recent, the UNAIDS program has implemented a country-by-country level effort that has provided more strategic planning assistance. This is in more than 50 countries now in Africa, Asia, Eastern Europe, Latin America, and the Caribbean. With AIDS as the leading cause of death in Africa, UNAIDS and its co-sponsors are organizing a broad-based partnership with private sector organizations to support government and local civic groups to combat the epidemic. And it is just recently that the pharmaceutical industry has begun to start doing a little bit of their share too. GlaxoWelcome, for example, has donated drugs for the prevention of mother-to-child HIV transmission, and Bristol-Myers Squibb has launched a 5-year research and training program in collaboration with governments, the UNAIDS organization, and academic institutions in Africa and in South America, in Africa, to benefit the countries of South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, Lesotho, and Swaziland. And this is an important first step, but these companies really need to do a lot more in their efforts. And I think that we really want to see a commitment from these pharmaceutical companies to be willing to provide drugs that help in the fight against AIDS at prices that might be, you know, affordable in a continent like Africa. We already know we struggle with affordability in this country. It would be absolutely, what we're looking at now in this country would be absolutely unaffordable in most others. And I'm pleased to see that the UNAIDS organization is working with the pharmaceuticals to start these new research trials, because if we are not there, we're not going to be looking at local strains of the virus, which have different demands and different treatments than what we're seeing here in the United States. The UNAIDS organization and the World Health Organization helped make possible Uganda's first HIV vaccine trial last February. And of course, the challenge is now finding the resources necessary to fund HIV reduction programs. Uganda and Thailand have been successful in reducing new HIV infections once they've sort of acknowledged the scope of the problem and initiated well-funded prevention type programs. The Secretary General, Kofi Annan, recently said that in some parts of Africa, the name for AIDS translates as shame has fallen on the earth. And he said, "My friends, shame will indeed fall on the earth if we turn our backs on those affected by AIDS and cast them into the shadows. Shame will fall on all of us if we do not wipe out every trace of prejudice and discrimination surrounding this disease." The World Health Community is working to meet the HIV/AIDS challenge, and I'm hopeful that we will succeed. I base that hope on some of the previous United Nations and World Health Organization successes that I want to share with everyone and remind all of us about. As all is not bleak and depressing in this struggle for a healthy world. Since its creation in 1948, the World Health Organization has been working hard to prevent and eradicate diseases in the developing world. And perhaps the greatest success story of that organization's history is the eradication of smallpox. Probably many in this room, like me, are too young to remember the smallpox horrors. But it was a very virulent disease that killed up to 20% of those people who were infected and left the remainder often disfigured, often blind. In 1967, it was epidemic in 31 countries, with 10 to 15 million people in this world contracting it per year. In 10 years, the World Health Organization was able to ensure that every person on the planet was vaccinated for smallpox. And the last case was detected in Somalia in 1977. A disease that killed or disfigured millions of people in this century was completely eliminated by World Health Organization efforts. They also created a very successful effort to treat YAWS, a crippling and disfiguring disease that afflicted more than 50 million people before the discovery of long-acting penicillin. And in West Africa, the World Health Organization and other UN agencies have dramatically reduced the incidence of river blindness. Throughout the world, childhood vaccination programs are reducing the incidence of 6 childhood diseases: diphtheria, tetanus, measles, tuberculosis, pertussis, and polio. And these efforts have reduced child mortality over the last 25 years from about 134 deaths per 1,000 live births to about 80. And so infant mortality has literally dropped 37% since 1970. So I'm optimistic about the future. More and more the United Nations is making the connection between development, peace, and security. And basic health care and education and employment are necessary for people to live in a world free from war. And conversely, war destroys infrastructure, diverts scarce resources, disrupts economic life, and undermines health and education. To quote the Secretary General of the UN once again, "Development has no worse enemy than war. if war is the worst enemy of development, health and balanced development is the best form of conflict prevention. The concept of promoting development to prevent war is not a new one. The founders of the United Nations set out to create a comprehensive organization that would address both peace and security issues and development. The intellectual and moral basis for post-war internationalism has been eloquently expressed by many of our world leaders, but two Americans stand out for their contributions to the United Nations and internationalism. And I don't want to overreach and claim that these two people are the only ones to stand out, but I can think of a few other people in our world's history who have made more of a difference, and they just happen to have been married to one another. And I speak, of course, of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. On January 6, 1941, President Roosevelt delivered his annual address to Congress. And in that speech, he laid out a vision for the world with four principles, commonly known as the Four Freedoms. And let me set the context. Europe at that time was at war. The Battle of Britain was raging. And no one in America knew what was going to happen next. And Franklin Roosevelt had just been reelected. Americans were beginning to understand that the war in Europe could spread. So there was a great deal of anxiety and fear. Roosevelt had led the nation through the Great Depression, but the economy was still not terribly strong, and the war wasn't helping. President Roosevelt used this occasion to express his vision for the future. And let me quote his famous lines. He said, "In the future days, which we seek to make more secure, we will look forward to a world founded on four essential human freedoms. First is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his or her own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want everywhere in the world. And the fourth is freedom from fear anywhere in the world." Roosevelt understood that we need a common set of principles that all citizens of the world could share to bring us together and to regulate relations between nations, to reflect the most basic understandings of human liberty. Throughout the war, Roosevelt kept sight of these principles as he helped to construct a post-war world, a post-war world that could strive to prevent war, promote development and decolonization, and establish a basic set of human rights. He never lived to see that post-war world or vision enacted, but his ideas and visions have lived on in both our hearts and the institutions he created. And the United Nations is a testament in many ways to Franklin Roosevelt. While he didn't live beyond World War II, Eleanor did. And I want to share with you her legacy and the many ways that she has left an enduring mark. I certainly find Eleanor Roosevelt a hero of mine. Aside from her remarkable life, fighting for civil and economic justice, and her dedication and perseverance, evidenced by a six-day-a-week column that she wrote for 20 years without ever missing a deadline except two times, once when she was stuck in a snowstorm in Siberia, and the other was the day that Franklin died. Can you imagine? Aside from her boundless energy traveling all over on fact-finding missions for Franklin, Eleanor Roosevelt was largely responsible for the development and the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It is a truly remarkable document in a number of ways, because for the first time, a common standard was created to discuss human rights. For more than that, it recognized the dignity of the human being, and it, for the first time, disconnected human rights as a concept of statehood. It forever changed the relationship between states and individuals. Before the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, people petitioned states for their rights. And now we view rights as belonging to individuals. It's a real shift. States are charged now with the responsibility and obligation to protect those rights. So last year, when the UN celebrated the 50th anniversary, the General Assembly President said, the declaration removed the issue of human rights once and for all from the sphere of the domestic jurisdiction of states. It has ceased to be of concern only to the individual holding those rights or to the society or state to which that individual belongs, and has become, by means of the declaration, a value that transcends borders, cultures, societies, and ideologies. Thank you so much. The human rights of every individual member of the human race are a matter of concern to all its other members. And Eleanor Roosevelt understood the profound impact that the Declaration would have. As a tireless advocate for civil and human rights, she knew that individuals needed to be linked together as human beings, all one human race, each with his or her own human destiny and human dignity. Our struggles as a world community to address human rights issues today would never have been possible without this transcendent vision. And it was a paradigm shift that now allows us to work toward a more unified sense of world with a common vision. The declarations, the basic rights contained in the declaration include the following: the right to life, liberty, and security of person, equal protection under law, protection from arbitrary arrest, detention, or exile, freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, freedom to assemble, the right to participate in our government, education, equal pay for equal work, the right to food, clothing, and housing, and medical care. And this is considered a birthright. I am awed by the foresight of Eleanor Roosevelt and the many others who since have been champions for this. It is remarkable that back then they had such a wonderful worldview. And I have great hope for the future of our planet, the future of our world. We have great challenges and clearly tremendous opportunities. We have a vision and we have resources. We have a commitment and we have energy. But I believe we have to have the will to act. I want to let you know as I close that last week I had my first opportunity to meet and speak briefly with the U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Richard Holbrooke. He had spent a couple of days on Capitol Hill trying as best he could figure to move forward some initiative to get Congress to commit to paying its back dues to the United Nations. And I can tell you he appeared quite frustrated after his many, many meetings. He was meeting with about a number of those of us in the freshman class in Congress, and we had begged him to just come by for a few minutes to give us an update on his activities and a number of the struggles in various locations in the world. But he seemed rather depressed about the series of meetings he had had. It appears that there is no specific plan right now before the end of this year or even the end of this session for the leadership to advance any type of legislative vehicle that would allow us to de-link this family planning and abortion issue from paying of our dues. They're using a number of different arguments. And one of the things that I hadn't understood until I had that meeting and went through a little bit more of the history was how coincidental this linkage really was. I know that oftentimes the wrong villains are identified in this problem of linkage of the UN dues, but that upon the election of a pro-choice president, there was a group who was eager to have a set of issues that they could hold hostage for advancing an anti-choice or anti-abortion agenda. And originally, this group of people were given a series of issues. It was the International Monetary Fund and the UN. And when the crisis in the currency became so great, they decided not to continue to hold that issue hostage to their negotiations on various issues of impacting choice and release that for full funding, but kept holding on to the United Nations. If you look at any of the amendments that actually come forth when we're debating the United Nations funding, they don't even mention, the language doesn't even mention the United Nations. It is coincidentally linked, but it was because there's this process of holding this issue hostage to these other negotiations. The arguments they're using on the Republican leadership right now, and since both sides are controlled by Republicans, are one, there has been a series of negotiations whereby the U.S. would pay its back dues but extract significant reforms on the United Nations. And the threat is if they don't actually go forth and do it this month, and this is, again, the argument being made to the current leadership, is that if the control of either house changes, you're probably going to get the back dues paid with no reforms if the other side controls. So you better do it now if you want those reforms. But the second is that this will become so crisis by the point that we elect the next president of the United States, whoever that might be, and those in the Republican leadership who are hopeful that it might be George W. Bush are pointing to the type of fiscal catastrophe he will inherit and the fact that he will have to begin a new term by, as they say, busting budgetary caps, and that's not a position that they were going to want to put a Republican brand new president in, if indeed that's what happens in the next election. And so those are the type of points they're using to negotiate right now. But Ambassador Holbrook said in 10 different meetings with top leaders in both houses, there were 10 different answers on how they might emerge from this and how they might be able to bring this forward, which left him feeling rather glum and rather disheartened about the prospects right now. We're all, and one of the things that that I was talking about with my colleagues as this meeting concluded was the fact that I would be coming home and getting a chance to speak with a couple of audiences who are recognizing this important day, and what could I encourage in terms of action. And I guess I would say keep on writing and keep on communicating, because even if you're preaching to the saved, as you are in my case, for me to be able to say that I got a lot of communication on this issue and it is important to the people that I represent, that provides more fuel for me to be effective in my persuasion among my colleagues. And so I do encourage you to keep active and certainly let our U.S. senators know of your concern in this regard. And with that, I want to wrap up and find out what you have to share or ask.